This is the Nichols Patrick for current federal tax developments for the week of November the 30th, 2015. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be talking to you about some of the developments that took place over the past week here in the area of federal taxes. It's that fun time of year again where we get into all of our tax planning. And for those of us who are out here doing the lecture circuit for continuing education, it's the time of year when we start doing the final push, because everybody likes to get their continuing education before the middle of December. So we have a couple of fun. So I have a couple of weeks here on the road. But luckily this week I'm recording from Phoenix, and hopefully next week I'll be able to record back here at home. I'm only going to be here for a short time. Got a number of trips coming up. And as I say, it's always kind of interesting and fun to get out there and give the lectures and see everybody. We're going to talk to you about a couple of issues that took place this week. Let's start with the first one here. We're going to talk to you about, in this case, the IRS put up a website notice where they told us that they and payroll services are going to be testing W-2 verification codes. And this particular notice that's on their website tells us that some payroll services are going to be adding a 16-digit code on some W-2s that they issue. Now, this is important because this is a test program. And it's important more that you understand what this is and isn't and can explain it to your clients, as well as understand what's going on at this point and what this program at this point does not do, which at the moment is it doesn't do a whole lot at the moment because it is simply a testing program. There will be a 16-digit code that will be on the W-2 that will be basically pointed out to you. It's going to be blocked into four sets of four characters. So you'll see it with dashes in between. It'll be 16 digits. Now, the IRS notes that even payroll services that are working under this system are not going to put this verification code on all of their W-2s. So it may be there, it may not. If it's there, you may be asked to enter it into your tax software. But there's a couple of things you need to be aware for this year. Number one, it is only being used for testing this year. Therefore, it is not going to actually be used by the IRS. At least at this point, there's no plan to use it to actually try to stop a fraudulent return. Remember, only some W-2s will have it, and entering the code is voluntary, so unless a crook's going to enter the 16-digit code, it's unlikely you're going to stop a return with this code. And the other catch is, as they note, it does not affect return processing, so it's not as if it's going to slow up your return if you don't have this code in there, or speed up the return if you do have this code in there, or change anything about your return if you miskey the code. The IRS is simply doing it to see if it, in fact, cuts down on the number of fraudulent returns. My guess is they'll discover that, at least for the moment it does, when they actually turn it live, the key is going to be whether how long it takes the people filing fraudulent 1040s to figure out how to break the code, A, and then B, is there any way the IRS can get this code on all W-2s? Well, that's going to be a problem because obviously you've got to get it on W-2s that are being issued by people who are preparing them by hand, which will probably not be a simple way to get it on a W-2. So we'll have to see how they do it. But in any event, this is a testing program they have right now trying to cut down on tax return fraud. We'll see whether or not this makes any difference, but just be aware it's going to be on some of your W-2s you'll receive this year. A bigger issue for us came out in Notice 2015-82. In this notice, the IRS announced that they are going to raise the de minimis amount that is going to apply for those taxpayers who are electing the de minimis test. So we're going to raise the invoice amount for those taxpayers making the de minimis election under the tangible property regulations who do not have an applicable financial statement. Now let's remember, under Regulation 1.263A-1F, a taxpayer has a right to make a de minimis election. The de minimis election, which remember must be made annually, allows the taxpayer to essentially get protection for their capitalization policy that they use on their books and records or financial statements. And we've got that or in there for a reason, but we'll talk about that in just a second. The catch being that in order to do this, you've got to qualify, and then the IRS put a dollar value limit, what they call the invoice cost limit. Currently, if you do not have an Apple financial statement, that invoice cost limit under the regulations was set at $500. The IRS had indicated when they published the final regulations that they work, not only when they published the regs, but also when they published the relief early this past year on filing a 3115s for small taxpayers, that they were considering raising the de minimis amount, but they wanted to figure out how much it should be. Now, let's start with the starting point on this. How do you determine if you got an Apple financial statement or not? That's key, because if you have an Apple financial statement, nothing's changing. You have an Apple financial statement if you have any of the following, and the first one of these you have is your applicable financial statement. An AFS includes a statement filed with the Security and Exchange Commission. Secondly, a statement audited by an independent CPA that's used for credit purposes, reporting to equity holders, or any substantial non-tax purpose. And finally, a statement other than a tax return required to be provided to an agency of the federal or state government, other than the IRS and SEC. So if you have an AFS, your invoice cost limit was $5,000. If you do not have an AFS, your limit is $500. Now, in addition to determining you don't have an AFS, when you make this election, you also have a couple of other requirements you have to meet. You must have had in place accounting procedures as of the first day of the year that defined which items you were not going to capitalize on your books and records, which ones you would expense off, and you have to actually have expensed those items off on your books and records. But if that's met and you attach the AFS and you attach the election to your return, then any item costing up to $500 that is not to be capitalized under your capitalization policy and which is not actually capitalized on your books and records will be allowed as an expense on the tax return, will not burn any of your 179, will not also cause any problems with the IRS claiming you have to capitalize it and depreciate it. It also will take it out of materials and supplies. Obviously, it doesn't apply to inventory. You know, there's a few other exceptions. Now, if you do have an AFS, the key difference is you have to have accounting procedures in place that are written as of the beginning of the year, and the item has to actually be expensed on your AFS. What the IRS decided in this notice was to raise to $2,500 the limit from $500 for those without an Apple financial statements. So you get half of the amount you get if you have an Apple financial statement. The IRS provides that this will apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1st of 2016. So that means effectively next year. But they noted that they won't challenge you on earlier years if you otherwise meet all of the requirements. Now, here's where we're going to have a little problem with what some people have done. In theory, that means that you can go ahead and go up to $2,500 in 2015. But the problem we've got is that some people reading the regulations, I never read the regs this way, but some people did, decided that you had to set your capitalization policy at no more than $500 if you did not have an AFS, or you couldn't get protection for anything under these rules. I had never read the regs that way. I simply read them to say that anything you went above $500 would end up being not protected under these regulations, and the IRS could force you to capitalize those things that are in excess of $500, going to, as we were told about in the information that was issued with the regulation, the IRS told us that basically in the preamble to the final regulations, that in fact nothing had changed from the old rules, and then it was just a question of did it misstate income. But if your policy right now says $500, then your problem is you can't meet all the requirements, or you should say your procedure said $500, because, of course, you essentially didn't have a procedure in place as of January 1st, 2015 that went up to $2,500. So for those people, they need to get a procedure in place by the January 1st of 2016. It actually says $2,500 is their number. Now the flip side on that, for those who, you know, if you did have a policy in place that was above $500, and many people continued their old policies, then you're fine. You can go ahead and go up to whatever your policy states. Remember, you have to do it under the policy. It has to be in accordance with that policy or procedure, and it has to be reflected on, for non-AFS, on your books and records. So be aware of this change. It's one we had expected would come from the service. It's one which they now have finally issued in Notice 2015-82. Next up, more things about the new regulations. This is Field Attorney Advice 2015-4601F. In this one, the IRS critiqued a taxpayer's attempt to use the proposed regulations method to a late partial disposition election. They decided to question how the taxpayer had come about doing their calculation. Now, this is significant because, remember, under regulation 1.168I-8, and this was technically under the temporary regulations, though things did not change dramatically under the final regs, but this one was this question was looking at somebody who was trying to do it for a year under the temporary regulations. They had been attempting to go back, take a look at their buildings, and find out how much could they write off under an accounting method change, claiming a late partial disposition. Presumably, this taxpayer had been one of those who'd been relatively conservative, who had capitalized most everything. So when they did a major roof repair, they capitalized that and depreciated it. When they did anything significant to the electrical system, they capitalized that. And so they realized that probably on their depreciation schedules for tax, they had a lot of duplicated things. They had, like, you know, three electrical systems and five roofs on many buildings. And these buildings went back quite a number of years, so this taxpayer appeared to have a bunch of buildings and a bunch of real estate. So they decided, it was too difficult to do a study to basically do each building by itself. So they did a statistical sample of their buildings and then used that to attempt to decide how much of the overall assets they had and of all the buildings they had could they write off under the late partial disposition election available for their accounting method change to comply with the tangible property regulations. Well, the IRS had a number of complaints. The first key complaint the IRS had was they didn't limit themselves to maker's assets. The IRS noted that maker's assets are what are required to be used. You know, this does not apply to things pre-makers. Pre-makers will include assets that were acquired essentially before the mid-1980s. So we had people with buildings here that went way back. The IRS noted that these particular rules only apply to makers' assets. That is an item to note if you're doing this type of thing or you have this type of situation on your 3115 that you filed last year. The IRS potentially could attack you if you did happen to have any pre-makers' assets. Raises a second problem, though, too. The IRS also noted that based on the method they had used, they couldn't show that they weren't trying to write off some specific assets that had basically no depreciable basis remaining. The IRS holds that this does not apply to assets for which there is no remaining depreciable basis. Now, that's kind of interesting read because, as you will note, one of the advantages we're getting from the late partial disposition by writing off part of the asset was writing off part of the accumulated depreciation, which meant it was not subject to the non-recapture 25% maximum rate. The IRS notes here that if the asset, in fact, had already been fully depreciated, tough luck. You're not allowed to write that off, so that accumulated depreciation will remain on the books. Now, we can talk about whether or not you could argue that that couldn't possibly be sold as part of the building. That's certainly be an argument going forward, but it is one of those issues to look at. The IRS also noted that, and this is probably part of the maker's problem, if the new and the old assets have different recovery periods, you can't use this method. And obviously, any pre-maker's asset that was being depreciated, let's say really old asset that goes back to, you know, before Ronald Reagan's time, we would be talking about here about a 50-year depreciable life under the old lives for buildings. Obviously, if you take a 50-year life roof, you're going to replace it with at most a 39-year life roof. Well, that's not the same life, and they say you can't do that. This memo is interesting to read just in case you have an exam that comes up where the agent starts looking at your change of method on a 3115 and your calculation of late partial dispositions. You may want to review this to get an idea about what exactly the service may complain about and what sort of things you might want to worry about or at least consider when you're looking at these particular issues. Next up, let's go to a court case here. This is Stanley versus the United States, which is case number 5:14-CV-05236. Always love those docket numbers. From the United States District Court of the Western District of Arkansas. If you subscribe to the American Federal Tax Reporter Second, which is part of the Thomson Reuters system, there the citation will be easier, 116 AFDR Second, paragraph 2015-5419. This particular case comes around the question about a real estate professional who's attempting to count time as an employee when that particular person is a holder of restricted stock in the S corporation that employed him. This taxpayer had restricted S corporation shares in a real estate company. He operated as the CEO of the company. So basically, he ran the operations. It managed and operated real estate. He owned a partial interest in a number of the properties that the company managed. And he had a 10% restricted interest. Under the terms of the interest, effectively, you know, if he left or retired, he had to sell the stock back to only the owners of the company if he didn't meet all the requirements, if he left, etc. And he actually did finally return it to one of the owners under this restricted agreement. But what he said was, during the years in question, the year under exam, he wanted to count his hours working as a CEO for this company as real estate hours for the real estate professional test, and that he could claim the losses on all the items flowing through on Schedule E that related to his rental real estate property along with this one. He also grouped his real estate properties with this operation for purposes of meeting the material participation test. So we had a couple of interesting issues at play here. Now, the interesting part here was the court found, the IRS argued that, wait, under Section 83, this would not be included in his income until the restrictions lapsed unless he filed an A3B re-election. And, as we'll notice, and under the S-Corp regulations, we're told that that stock's not considered issued. The IRS said, well, if that stock doesn't count as issued for purposes of the S-Corp rules, then it's not issued for these rules, so he has a 0% ownership interest of shares. The court said, no, there's nothing linking Section 83, or the S-Corp rules for that matter, to Section 469's test for real estate pros of being at least a 5% owner. The court found that he had 10% of the legally issued shares, even if they were restricted, and as such, he met the requirement under the regulations that he be at least a 5% owner to count work as an employee for an enterprise in which he materially participated. The court also found that because this company managed real estate and was managing the various properties, that in fact, under the de minimis rule, they could combine the rental real estate properties with this particular operation to determine if he was materially participating in this operation as a whole. The court made an interesting slice, and we don't have all the facts to understand why this was significant, but the court said that the rental-only rule in 469C7 for determining real estate professional that talks about participation of the rental properties only was solely used to determine if you are a real estate pro. After we determined you're a real estate pro, then we were able to regroup if we could, under the regulations taken as a whole, we could still group it with something else. So it was an interesting issue. But the big one probably to note here was that bit about making him a 10% shareholder. It's important to note the difference between the S corporation rules and the Section 83 rules. You know, talking about those issues and the ones that are 469. That under the real estate pro, at least in this case, the district court in Arkansas determined that this person was a 5% owner, even though he may very well and probably was not getting a K-1 from the S corporation, because since he hadn't made an A3B election, they weren't treating these shares as issued. So it was a unique and interesting case. If you have that fact pattern, study it. Understand, though, a couple of caveats here. Number one, it is simply a district court case from Arkansas. So unless you actually live in Arkansas, your taxpayer at least lives in Arkansas, and your taxpayer gets this judge, we may have to talk this through all over again with a new judge who may or may not see it the same way. And also, I doubt the service is likely going to follow this case, so be aware, you know, tell your clients that you probably have a basis for taking the position that they're a real estate pro, but tell them that it's also very possible the IRS will challenge that position. Finally, the final case this week is Matthews versus Commissioner, TC Memorandum Decision 2015-225. In this particular case, we have an individual who's receiving a veteran's disability payment. Those disability payments were not taxable under Section 104A of the code. Now, he said, now this particular guy got behind, and to say he got behind in paying his taxes, and putting it mildly, he had taxes owed from 8 separate years running from 2000 to 2011. So he had a lot of tax outstanding for a lot of years. Now, he was in there. Now, obviously, the question he owed tax was not on the table. He owed tax. We're in collections at this point. The issue was, could he basically, you know, propose, could he get some sort of collection relief because he had an inability to pay? And he was trying to get, and he was trying to compare and say, the IRS said, well, we'll go ahead and we'll take you on an installment agreement. But the IRS, in computing that installment agreement, how much they would accept as a minimum installment agreement, counted his veteran's disability in his ability to pay. The taxpayer, now the way the numbers worked, honestly, if he did not have the veteran's disability counted in his monthly pay, he effectively had no dollars left with which to pay any installment agreement, so zero. He would have been basically currently not collectible and likely to stay there for the entire 10 years. So this is not a minor issue facing the courts at this point. And he may still be not collectible effectively, because we'll talk about some of the issues that arose in this case. But he was saying, well, I want this installment agreement, so I want the IRS to accept and start stop threatening to do anything if they get it down to zero. Now, the taxpayer said there were two reasons why that his disability should not count. Number one, he said it was not taxable under Section 104A of the code. And the IRS forms asking for, their Form 433A and the Internal Revenue Manual simply talk about income. And he said, well, income must mean things that are taxable income in the Internal Revenue Code. And my disability is not taxable, so that we don't count that income in determining my ability to pay. The tax court said, no, sorry. They said, this is ability to pay. So ability to pay means could you pay, not whether the service could make you pay, not whether it's taxable or not. The court said taxable doesn't matter because you're getting expenses in determining ability to pay that are non-deductible. So we're not looking at taxable income nets. We're looking here at just general ability to pay. The court said it's unfortunate that the instructions and the Internal Revenue Manual just use the term income, but the court said since the whole point of this was ability to pay, there seemed to be no rational basis for excluding what was basically the vast majority of his income from the calculation. The court said somebody receiving that, if this gentleman did not have $3,300 a month received, you had somebody in the same position as him without getting $1,300 a month to receive, that person has much less ability to pay than this gentleman has. So it says, and since that's our case with ability to pay, that's what counts. The taxpayer also argued that essentially, since these are service-connected disabilities and the IRS has restrictions on levying against certain service-related disabilities, they can't levy against them, that, well, that also means it shouldn't count as income. The court said, well, kind of like before, we're looking at your ability to pay, not necessarily whether the service could make you pay. And we're saying those funds are freely available to you. You could use them to pay. The fact that the service maybe couldn't take them from you does not change the calculation that they're still there to determine your ability to pay and whether the IRS has to accept the agreement or whether it's basically an abuse of discretion on the part of the service to deny you the installment agreement unless you include those in the calculation. And so the court said effectively, sorry, you can't exclude either one of those. So that tells us an issue to worry about. Remember, when looking at hearing collections, the question, as the court made clear, is ability to pay, not necessarily whether the service could get that money from you directly. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of November 30th, 2015. Be sure to visit us at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com for write-ups about these cases and some links to the actual source material of the items we discussed this week. Also, go check there during the week because we post updates during the week on that site. And then be sure to join us next week. We'll talk to you about what goes on here in this upcoming first week of December in taxes as we discuss what's coming up here as we get into the tax planning season.